Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Fun Friday with a special guest, of course, as always, the principal founder of Burns Capital Partners, TJ Burns. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on. And we've been able to have the pleasure of getting to know each other over about, say, a year's time. I think we officially met in person at Raise Fest in Louisville of last year. And of course, you came to our event in Manhattan. So it's been nice to rub elbows and hopefully we'll be doing a deal together coming up here in the future.
That's right.
Absolutely. Well, I guess tell us about your story. And before getting to real estate and capital raising, what were you doing before? What are you currently doing? And how did you find this space?
Yeah, so I'm one of those people that is doing double duty right now. So I work as an engineer at Amazon currently, and I'm building this business in tandem with that. Before I got into real estate, I was full-time engineer at a company called Blink Smart Home. Some people have heard of it. Some people have heard of the sister company Ring. But I actually joined that company as the first mechanical engineering hire back in 2017. That was right out of school. And I kind of caught this wave in the business where we were scaling up. We got acquired by Amazon a short while after that. And ever since then, I've been leading the mechanical design on Blink products, doorbells, cameras. We've scaled the team up a bunch since I joined. So we really have a group of rock stars now. But that's what I've that's where I come from, right? And then with real estate, it's something that I was learning about while I was building my career, and eventually I decided to get more involved, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Absolutely. So I guess what was the introduction to real estate? Did you have a family member in it? Did you have, anyone who had the investing bug, or did you just kind of back into it out of happenstance?
Yeah, no family connection. If anything, I waited a long time to get involved because of all the horror stories that I had heard from friends of friends and, friends of parents and all these things about tenants and real estate and buying in your backyard that aren't necessarily true today. So there's a boring way I got in, and then there's a more exciting way. And at first it was very boring. I just kind of stumbled upon it through my own personal finance journey, looking for ways where I could build wealth, listened to a ton of podcasts and books, and spent about 3 years just kind of spinning my wheels. Didn't really understand how to break into the industry. Wasn't looking for mentors. Wasn't going to meetups. Was just kind of making random offers in, my hometown and other markets. So that's the boring story.
And is that for
The
like single family homes? Is that duplexes? What type of real estate assets were you making offers and bids on?
Yeah, I was kind of all over the place. Single family, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes. I totally had shiny object syndrome. I'd look at a market and I would convince myself that was the market where everybody was making money. So I would go
Right.
and try to make some offers there. Of course, I would get no callbacks because I had no relationships there. I had no advantages, and I did that for a while, right? And then in 2020, this is the more exciting catalyst to my journey. I was in Boston, where I lived. I was going home from a friend's house, and I came across a wallet in the street that ended up belonging to a young, successful real estate investor. And I went home, I looked that person up, I found their Instagram page, I saw all the cool things that they'd been doing for the last 2 years, all the deals they'd done, all the mistakes they had made and overcome. And I just remember thinking, I have to meet this person. What value could I bring this person besides giving them the wallet back that would make them want to do deals with me? And I thought about that for the next couple of days as we set up a time to meet up, and it kind of occurred to me that really my only advantage in that situation was that I could invest some capital that I was getting from my job at Amazon. And this is before I knew anything about syndications or funds or private placements. So when we met up, I just said, hey, in a very low pressure way, if you ever are looking for a partner, keep me in mind. I'd love to potentially invest some money in the deals you're doing. And it took us a little bit, maybe 9 to 12 months going back and forth. I remember we had a deal and it fell out of contract, and And then we did our first deal together with me as a limited partner and that individual as the general partner. Very small deal. It was just myself and I think his mom was the only other limited partner. And it was exactly what I was looking for. It allowed me to focus on my high stress tech job and still get a piece of real estate deals. So we did one and then we did another. And then I met other people in the industry. I invested in more deals and I was hooked. And then along that route, I realized that, well, I think I like real estate a lot more than the other people, it seems like. Not people in the industry, but other limited partners that are like, I just want to write a check and go about my life. For me, it was really fun. And I realized I knew more than I thought. And that I could actually take a more active role by starting funds or co-sponsoring deals and add value to operators that way. Where I would go out to my tech network and find people that also were in my shoes or were like me, you know, people that wanted to invest in real estate but just didn't have the network to do that. So and that kind of led me to starting my business and then scaling it up.
So, what was this asset that you first initially invested in?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I failed to mention that while I was doing limited partner deals, I bought a single family home in Florida that it was a new build. It took 16 months to build. It was supposed to take six. But it was during,
It's about right. Yeah, no supply issues. Yep.
supply issues. Everything was delayed. It was when prices were going crazy. So that took 16 months to build, and at the end of it, the house was worth double from what we originally paid. So 16 months goes by, I'm making all the interest payments on the loan, and then the house is done. We get our CO, and I sell it, which I sold it in 2022. So that one I lucked out on. I've also bought a few small multifamily locally that I've used the house hack strategy for. You know, live in one side of a duplex, move out. Bought a three unit, lived in one side of that. But all along that, I realized this is great, but I want to focus on being a limited partner, investing in syndications, raising money eventually. And the first deal we did there was a 16 unit down in Florida. Just bought it at a fantastic cost basis, did simple renovations to most of the units. And just caught the wave of the market. And that deal was also sold 18 months later, and LP returns were north of 2x.
So you basically got in a situation where you've had a lot of these deals in your short tenure in real estate that have kind of been quicker velocity, it sounds like, and turned over. Have you basically repositioned now where you have a long-term mindset for these deals that are more kind of 5 to 7 year kind of game plans, considering that the market isn't as hot and as gangbusters as it was during the COVID run-up?
Totally. Yeah. You know, the I know and I started investing as a limited partner in, you know, 2020, 2021, around that time. And it seemed like everybody was just flipping properties.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really in line with the messaging of real estate. And we're gonna hold it for 5 years, we're gonna refinance it, you know, it's gonna
Take
cash
advantage of
flow.
all the tax amenities and whatnot. Yeah. You know,
Yeah,
really grow
exactly.
rich, get rich slowly.
Yeah, it was just crazy, as you know. And I realized that people were doing that because the market was moving so fast. And I'm glad that I went through that because now I can compare that to the environment we're in today, where it's much more about the fundamentals. It's back to, you know, the basics. What's our revenue? What are our expenses? How do we manage this asset? And for me, you know, I try to ask myself with deals, is this something I want to own for 10 years or more? Even if we get rid of it in 2 years, you know, if that happens and it makes sense, that's great. But, you know, I've done a few deals where we buy them and it's very clear, like 2 or 3 months in, that we're like, we don't want to own this thing. You know, we bought it at a great basis and,
You can make money on it, but it's not something you want to be going home to or going back to or spending a lot of time and energy on. So, with that said, what makes something in the camp of I don't want to own this, or what makes you feel, oh yeah, I'll hold this indefinitely if I can? What are those components that kind of, create that, because I'm sure it's not just a return situation, it's probably a tenant profile situation, right? So what kind of has the DNA of a keeper versus a in and out play?
Yeah, you're totally right with that. In terms of tenant base, I've invested in a number of C-class deals over the years, and they're just somewhat much more management intensive. That we've gravitated away from that and more towards like your B class, B plus class asset, maybe B minus in a B plus location. The being that I do deals in the Northeast, the houses are a bit older. Sometimes we have multifamily buildings that are from the early 1900s.
Wow.
So I know people, they look at newer vintages. For me, I just tried to work with people that have a lot of experience in managing whatever we're buying. If it's a 1900s colonial 15 unit, then I want to work with somebody that's done 30 of those, right? If so yeah, that's probably the biggest thing is like who am I working with and what's their experience? Anybody can make money in any market. And people are going to lose money in any market. So, for me, it just comes down to who is that person I'm working with? What are their advantages? And
So I've thought about this before a lot, and it's clearly that, or clear, I should say, that there's certainly a lot of money to be made in any sort of real estate investing. But it seems as if sometimes you can get some really sweet basis plays on, call it sub probably 20 units. That 20, call it 4 to 20 units is probably a sweet spot, and then you're gonna get more sophisticated, 20 to 50, and then so on and so forth, 50 to 100. And then, 150 plus, it's, probably more institutional equity and whatnot. So how do you handicap deals when it's smaller, number of units, sub 20 units as opposed to bigger projects, right? Do you typically steer towards the smaller ones, or do you also like kind of working with folks like yourselves at Lone Star, where we're more in the institutional mid-market space?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I almost look at those different spaces as different asset classes because what it takes to manage a portfolio of 5 to 6 unit properties is way different than managing a 200 unit property. And for me, what I've been used to is the smaller side. That's just the people I've worked with to date, they have experience in sub 50 units. And I've seen what goes into managing those. I've really gravitated towards people that own their property management companies. I think property management is one of the biggest failure points for any deal. And I've seen it happen with some of the deals I'm a limited partner in. And owning that facet of your business is huge because then you have all of the control. But with that said, I just don't have a ton of experience with the huge buildings. And it would be crazy for me to say that that's a worse place to be than the smaller side. I think that there's more inefficiency when you're buying sub 50 unit buildings. You get a lot more inexperienced sellers, mom and pop operators, people that are hobbyist investors. I don't think you get as much of that with 200
No,
unit buildings. Not at all, right?
absolutely not at all. You have mandates with regards to equity. If you're going to sell it, there's no off-market deals, no direct to seller. If the owner of Lone Star Capital or the owner of XYZ firm has a divorce going on, yeah, it doesn't matter. There's not going to be any panic selling there. But if there's a 20 unit property where there's a divorce going on, well, yeah, you might have to sell that property. So it's just a different level of, there's a different level of work associated and a different, I guess, control level and factors that goes in, that go into play with regards to the bigger units versus the smaller ones. But and there's no right or wrong per se, but it's just a different ball game to your point. And as you said, they are basically different asset classes, regardless of being multifamily, right?
Yeah, and I think you guys have done a really good job with creating opportunities, which I think is the most important thing, no matter what you're buying. So I've seen some of the deals you've done, you've found ways to get tax exemptions, things like that, where you're able to position yourself better than other people. And I've seen also, you've been able to get reductions in pricing, just based on your reputation. So all of that is included in things that I'm looking for. I want to know that the people I'm partnering with, they have some significant advantage in what we're doing. I don't want to just be some other average investor in the market. I want to work with the best. And I think raising money positions you well to do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you get to thick of the litter and you get to see what the best deals come forward to you. You get less bias because you're going to see the final product where the pricing comes in, where things are truly trading at, and understand the basis as opposed to, being the one making the offers and stuff. That does give you an advantage there. So segueing into speaking of deals that you're looking for and advantages and whatnot, what typical type of deals do you typically raise for? Do you typically raise for, multifamily, self-storage, short-term rental funds? Where do you look to invest? And to park money and raise money for.
Typically, it's been multifamily. I've done small multifamily, mid-size, which I would say is around 50 to maybe slightly larger than 50 units. I've done that in the past, and I plan to continue with that. I think it's a great asset class, and it's not going anywhere, for a lot of reasons. I've raised money for short-term rentals in the past, and recently I've started raising money for private credit, what people commonly know as debt funds. And I think that's a really exciting place to be right now, too.
Right. And with that said, what about those opportunities make you most excited, or I guess get you excited to want to, I guess go into the deal? What are the metrics that you're seeking and looking for to, make you want to say yes to something?
Yeah, I mean, with multifamily, I especially being in the smaller to mid-sized realm, buying at a great basis is something that's really important that I'm looking for, because when you buy at a great price, it really gives you a lot of optionality into what you want to do with the property. You could sell it tomorrow and make money. You can likely refinance it sooner than you would be if you bought at a higher basis. I know some people are doing a lot of assumable loans right now, and I think those are great, but it also locks you into, certain terms for a long time.
Yeah, I think assumable loans are interesting, and I don't know how much of an advantage it is depending upon the tarmac of that deal, because if it's only 2 3 years, it's basically just a bridge debt bridge deal, right? So I don't know if there's that much of an advantage. And also, sometimes people sell it there and they have a higher price, and yes, you maybe get a little more cash flow on the front end if you've got a good rate, but you're basically buying into a basis that's higher than what it should be. So I'd always take a higher rate but a lower, obviously, basis, because you make money on the purchase, not the exit, as you're alluding to, for sure. So with that said, do you look for cash flow? Do you look for lift with some of these deals, or is every kind of story different? You're obviously younger like me. Are you really focused more on the equity multiple and wealth growth as opposed to kind of cash flow? Because obviously, if you're an engineer, you're probably making good money. So you're probably just looking, I imagine, with just the on long-term growth and basically creating a big lift and, truly adding value there, right? So what do you prioritize when you're doing this?
Yeah, surprisingly, I've been doing more cash flow investing lately. And the reason for that is very specific to me. It's because the private equity business, and within private equity, there are the huge players, and then there are the very micro players like myself. It's not a business where you make a lot of money today. It's a great business if you're looking over long time horizons, 5 years, 10 years. But when you're doing a typical multifamily deal, I'm not making much money up front. I'll make money when we sell the deal. So in building Burns Capital Partners, I am building this business that requires capital to run. It's not a business that generates a ton of capital for the amount of work that's done. So it's really helpful to have cash flow from other sources. And right now in multifamily, it's a little bit harder to invest as an LP and see significant cash flow from day one. With that said, in private credit, it's an asset class where you are seeing consistent cash flow, and it's very attractive right now for a few different reasons. So lately I've been doing more of those deals, as an LP, and then also as a fund manager. And you pay higher taxes on that. I live in New York, and like you do, and really get banged up on taxes, but other than that, I've really been enjoying seeing those checks come in.
Right. And do you plan to eventually phase out of the engineering space, or using that just as a vehicle to raise more money, to get me investors? Is your ultimate goal to be out of a more traditional 9 to 5 and to transition into full-time capital raising and sourcing things of that nature?
When's this podcast interview dropping?
Exactly. No, for yeah, right. In a couple of weeks, right?
Okay. Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, maybe we'll edit this part out. Maybe not. We'll see. But
Right.
I'll take a pause and then I'll answer.
Right.
I think when I started in tech, I remember feeling like I wanted to do my own thing at some point. I had a strong desire to go build my own business, but I didn't know what that looked like because when I went to college, it was right around the rise of the unicorn company, go raise a ton of money, gain a bunch of employees, get a big office, and shoot for the moon on something that was completely new. And that didn't resonate with me at all. It didn't fit my goals, and I just didn't understand another way to build a business that was just gonna fund my lifestyle and allow me to do whatever I wanted to do. But I had that desire, like many people do, to go and be my own boss, have my own hours, spend time with my son as I saw fit, and with my wife as I saw fit. And that never left me. If anything, it only got stronger. And yeah, I mean, with that, I'm building this business. It's a business that there are high stakes in it. I'm raising money from people that they worked hard for, and I'm going to have to at some point move full time into that in order to keep up the level of quality that I want to keep up in my business.
Understand, and thank you for that background too. So that said, regarding deals and working hard to source it and the high stakes of it, what are some of the key metrics that get you excited or nervous for a deal?
Yeah, I mean, we covered buying at a great basis. I think we covered actually vertical integration as well. So just to define that, it's when the operator owns the property management company. So the PM being the one that's doing all the day-to-day work, they're in charge of leasing, they're in charge of maintenance requests, everything that's on the ground, the PM is doing. And I think some limited partners get those confused, the asset manager and the PM. They're not the same, but sometimes the asset manager owns the PM, and that's something that I look for. I think finding a unique niche is a nice thing to have. It's not always required, but there are different groups that are doing some interesting things where they're only one of a few, as opposed to being one of many other investors in a market. And I think anytime you can create some separation from everybody else, then that's a good thing, and it creates some opportunities. In terms of things that make me nervous, sometimes LPs will send me deals from other operators, and they'll ask me what my opinion is on them. And I'm thinking of this because I just had one yesterday. Things where operators are stepping outside of the market that they know. They might be a multifamily investor and in Texas, let's say, and then they're going and buying properties in Mississippi or some other market where it's not exactly it's not the same. There's different laws, and don't get me wrong, sometimes that works, but it's just something that makes me a little bit nervous.
Well, it's funny you should say that because we're guinea pigging a deal theoretically right now. We're buying a first deal in San Antonio. Now we're a Texas sponsor, but still, it is a leap of faith and a bit more of a risk for us to be out of Dallas or Houston, where we've got a very, very large portion of our portfolio just specifically there. I mean, we've got, $400 million just in Houston alone. That's a hefty amount of our portfolio in bulk there, but to your point, then you get out of states, it's very, very challenging. And the nuances are different, the laws are different, what's necessary there is different. So it definitely is something to think about when you are there. And would you typically speaking want to be?
I will say on that, there are exceptions, and I think groups like Lone Star is an exception to that. I was at your conference. I saw the network that you guys have. I saw how professional you are. I think there are groups that can be successful wherever they go because they're not gonna willy-nilly enter a market without doing their homework, right? And at the end of the day, you're buying multifamily in one area. you can apply it to other areas as long as you just learn the new game of being there. But something I've seen that's scary is more of like these hobbyist investors that just because they're buying in one area, they'll go off to another area and think that it applies. So sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to
No,
clarify
it's
that.
perfect. Yeah, no, that's great. And I appreciate that insight. That said, how do you vet a sponsor or someone that you work with? What are some things that you need? You obviously mentioned that you need vertically, or ideally, you have property management in-house, construction in-house, vertical integrations. But outside of that, what else do you look for? Do you look for a certain number of exits, a certain unit count, a certain time of space in real estate? What gets you excited to say yes? Because obviously we all have to start somewhere, and anyone at any point can find a deal where you're gonna make a lot of money, but there's just naturally more risk associated with working with someone new. So how do you balance that? And I guess just, when you vet someone, what are you seeking? What are you looking for? And how do you get comfortable?
So one thing that I've done in the past, and I'm trying to keep this up as much as I can, is I always invest as a limited partner with the group before I actively partner with them. And while it's a little bit more drawn out and expensive from a capital allocation standpoint, it allows me to see how that group is going to communicate with their LPs. It gives me a window into their business and their willingness to share information on what they're doing, because things aren't always transparent. It's very hard to be completely transparent with all the moving parts that go into operating a deal, right? So as an LP, I'll ask questions and I'll try to gauge what the response is and how willing that sponsor is to share information. I think at this stage in the game for me too, the reputation is very important. So, we have a lot of similar people in our network, and when I'm approaching a new operator or they're approaching me, I want to see what other people think of them. And I'd like to see exactly if there are any deals that have not gone according to expectations and what the operator has done about that. And I think right now there are a lot of deals that have not gone according to
It's
expectations.
a great time to start asking these questions.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a deal going bad. If you're in this business long enough, there will be deals that go bad. There are
You
so many variables.
live and die by the sword of the market, right? So there's just situations where, hey, was this truly out of your control? If you made a mistake, how bad was the mistake? Did you get greedy on the front end, not thinking you needed to buy a rate cap, something like that, right? That are super important to think about for sure.
Yeah, and then I'll add to that list. I care about the sponsor's financial stability. I don't hear a lot of people talking about that, but I'd like to see that the operator is not living and dying by the fees that they're generating, and that they more so look at the fees as a way to operate their business. And I think that aligns incentives a little bit better. And I've done some deals where we've had to infuse capital as a GPs, in order to fund a cash crunch and continue with operations without bothering our LPs for more money. And I think when you're more financially stable, you have the ability to do those things. And it really comes in handy.
So how do you feel about co-invest then? Because naturally that's a big thing. It's stability. We're kind of interesting here. And the reason why I asked this question is because we agree where financial stability is super important. But if a sponsor has got, let's say, $1 million and hit that 10% threshold, which people look for, well, wouldn't you rather have them raise money for someone else and then they come in later to save the day if there's, some shortfall there? So obviously the sponsor needs to have something in the deal, right? But co-invest, it gets tricky. We'd rather look at it where we've got expenses, not to say we can't afford everything, but it just doesn't make sense for us to be putting, let's say, on the three property portfolio that we close, $4 million out of a $40 million raise. That's just a little bit high for what makes sense. So ask the question to you, where do you kind of fall there? Is it case by case? Is it meaningful? Are you rigid on that? I'd be very curious to hear your perspective.
It's a really good question, and you're right. There is a standard for that in the marketplace.
A theoretical standard, and it's a moving standard, was what I've learned. Everyone's different. So the word I'm hearing now is meaningful. So I don't know. That's open interpretation.
You're right. And I think this is a little bit against the grain, but I would side more with what you guys are saying in that We would rather put less into the deal up front. We'll put something into the deal so that we have quote unquote skin in the game, but we're going to hold back capital. That way, in case anything happens, we're still able to help. I think the flip side of that would be somebody who takes all of their liquidity and dumps it into a deal up front and says they have the maximum amount of skin in the game, but then when things go wrong, they have no flexibility to help out. And I think the reason for that, going back to why I believe this, is because to me, capital is something that I can always go out and make more money. I really believe that I could do that, right? So if I invest into a deal and I personally lose it, let's just say as a limited partner, in somebody else's deal, then that's okay. But reputational risk is something that is a much harder to come back from. So to me, the real skin in the game is the reputation you've built and the reputation you're trying to maintain as you're going through difficult situations and deals. And yes, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, no, and the reason why I asked is because there's probably a lot of people right now that maybe didn't put in their 10% co-invest, or put in a little bit less because it was a big deal. But now they could be doing a member loan or a pref infusion or basically giving money back to meet some payments or to, stabilize the deal from a capital stack perspective. So that's super, super crucial. Sorry, one second.
Oh, you're good.
So back to, you wanting to invest first as an LP, have you ever not raised for a deal or worked with a sponsor after you invested in it personally and then you realize, hey, this is probably just not a group I feel comfortable with bringing other people's money to it? Because I appreciate your perspective there. I'd rather lose my money before I lose someone else's. That's just how I feel. Maybe I'm too conscientious in that regard. But have you ever had a situation where you went through the process, you went through the hoops and things like that, and it not be a good fit, and you feel so happy that you didn't bring other people into that opportunity?
Yeah, all the time. I've invested in including the deals I've raised money for. It's around 20, different deals at this point. And a lot of those have just been me as a limited partner. I say me, it's me and my wife as a limited partner. There are tons of operators that are good people. People are behind them. They're doing great. But for some reason or another, I just wouldn't feel comfortable raising money alongside them. Usually it comes down to communication is one big one. Kind of getting more familiar with their numbers and their process and just not being comfortable with the level of risk they're taking on. Understanding what their experience level is at after investing with them. I'm reasonable. I've been in the past at least reasonably loose with who I will invest as an LP with. But when it comes to actively partnering, I am a lot stricter, a lot pickier. I've really only done deals with a handful of people, maybe three or four different groups.
Right. And with that said, is it typically communication with monthly reporting that's an issue? Is it basically, over promising and under delivering? How does someone, not convert you if you say yes to them? Where are they losing you on your end? And what do you expect that they're not doing where they're falling short?
Some of the big ones are uncovering information about what's going on after the fact that I believe is important information that wasn't shared up front. And the tricky part about that, as you know, is that there's so much that goes into these deals, and it's very hard to communicate everything to limited partners without losing them. And I imagine with the investors that you at Lone Star raise money from, you work with some family offices, some more sophisticated groups. The level of due diligence is a lot higher, and the level of comprehension is probably a lot higher. In the retail world, especially if you're working with people who are coming into this industry from something else, if you bog them down with too much information at deal time, it's great to educate people along the way, and that's why it's so important to keep these relationships up and do a lot of education before you have a deal. But if you put too much into your presentation, it's like you're probably going to lose people, right? So it's important to balance those two things of giving them enough information, really just all the critical information, and not, giving them too much fluff. So long-winded answer for part of it was that. And then the other thing is just doing what they say they're going to do. That's something, it's so simple, but I think so many people don't do that. And I think everybody's guilty of it at some point, but the people that do it less are the ones that I try to work with, or at least the people that when they pivot, they keep their investors informed, and then we keep moving forward.
Well, I think you said it right there, is you pivot, right? And obviously there's situations where, I'm sure for the both ends of this, and usually it's not this side, but I'm sure there's a lot of people who they were like, oh, we're gonna hold this deal for 5 years. They bought the deal in 2020, 2019, or whatever it may be, or 2020, and it turns out that the market went up, X percent in everyone's face. And yeah, we're not remodeling anything, we're not even gonna paint it, we're just gonna sell it and do nothing and flip it and do like that. So there's situations where that occurs, and there's situations where, wait, you raised all this money for CapEx and you didn't do CapEx. Well, what the heck are you doing with it? Did you not raise enough money? Are there issues here that we should be aware of? Is this a deeper problem? So definitely an interesting thought and concept there with regards to, where that is done, and the explanation behind it is super, super crucial. I'm actually gonna ask you a question though that I've never asked anyone before on the show. And this is gonna be, hopefully you find this interesting. If someone came to you, or if you know what you know right now, and $1 million plopped into your account, how are you going to divvy up that $1 million to deploy over, let's just say, the next 24 months? Where would you put that money? Would you put a certain number in the debt fund, as you mentioned, the short-term rental funds, multifamily? But if you got that $1 million and you had to deploy it within the next 24 months, how would you do it? How would you break it up? How much would you put into each deal? Where would that land with you?
So I'll start with the fun part of that. I think I would take some small percentage, 10 to 20% perhaps, and I would consider that more of the venture capital, not in the traditional sense, but I would put that money into deals with great operators in asset classes that I haven't been in yet. And I'd probably even venture out and invest in some businesses with that, and other things I haven't done yet. So, really just stuff that I'm not familiar with, I'm looking to learn more about. I think there's some interesting upside. And the remainder, I would split it right now across multifamily and private credit, which are the two things that I'm pretty focused on right now. And one's good for cash flow, one's a little bit less riskier, one's great for building wealth and creating upside and tax benefits. And I think there's a ton of opportunity in both of those, as we're recording this, February of 2024.
Right. Awesome. So you'd break up, say, 200K roughly would be for more opportunistic educational side. The other 100,000 would be delegated towards basically, hard money, debt funds, private credit, and then multifamily. And I guess you, with the liquidity of some of these, because I'm pretty sure you get 90 to 30 day liquidity on these, where you can kind of keep that money there and then probably have it all sit there at, 10 to 13%. You get 10 to 13 or 9 to 13%, probably. You make that in cash. And then as good deals come up, you probably liquidate and probably distribute accordingly. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I just thought of a question that I've been talking to a friend about this idea. He's another operator, and I'm curious how you guys think about this at Lone Star. So I've noticed that some operators are spinning up a debt fund arm of their business. So, when you think about different businesses that can work well with multifamily investing, owning your property management companies is pretty high in that list. I think access to capital, and building, your own bank per se is something that I've seen other operators do. Is that something that you guys at Lone Star are thinking about at all? If has it popped into your heads that you might start a debt fund to fund some of, the projects you're doing?
This is a very good inside information, inside access here. And the answer is no. And Rob and I at one point thinking about doing some sort of a course for capital raising and whatnot. But seeing as that that space is, I'm not gonna say it's too busy, but we've, both have a friend who just started, his mastermind on top of the mastermind we're both in collectively right now. So you could read between the tea leaves there. There's a lot of that out there. And I certainly think that although there's a lot of money to be made there, the business needs to be the business. Okay. So once we start coming out with, a mastermind and a course and this and that, it starts distracting us from what our main focus should be, which is just multifamily real estate and being really great there and doubling down our operations. Once we have all these ancillary things there, I think it kind of dilutes what we're doing. That's not to say that what Dan Hanford and Passive Investing are doing is great with regards to their, debt fund with their car wash stuff and with their multifamily stuff. They're awesome. It's just not something that I think we want to do. We want to just be very niche and a mile deep and inch wide with that, as opposed to kind of the other options out there to make money. But it's, I don't think it's even been thought about, but I see the value in that for sure. And Neil Balwa, I think, has famously said that if you want to basically raise over 2 times what you're currently raising, maybe 2.6, 2.9 times, I saw, just add another asset class to your investors. So I see the value in that for sure, but it's not what we want to do.
Makes total sense, and
Yeah.
it's something I look for, in operators. I want them to be very focused on what they're doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, very good. What asset classes do you think, or asset, yeah, what assets, I should say, do you think you're going to do best coming up here? There's mobile homes, which should be theoretically doing well because they're pretty recession resistant. Multifamily, workforce housing should be doing pretty well. But in your opinion, what do you think will do best? Obviously you mentioned private credit could be that for sure, but what do you think the best opportunities here coming up, or if you met invested before, should you feel safe in?
Yeah, I'll caveat by saying I'm very biased to what I'm putting my money into, what I'm raising money
Likewise.
for, of course. So, the question's almost what are you working on right now? And like I said, it's private credit, doing loans sub $10 million, which is a very fragmented section of the lending market, because in that realm you have a lot more like local credit unions that are originating those loans, and those banks are having issues right now, which we've all seen in the news. So that's an area that I like a lot right now. And then I've been doing a fair amount of multifamily type deals in supply constrained markets. So and I'm trying to think of things that people don't usually talk about. So this one is that I actually really like the Northeast as a place to invest. I know that's
Well, no,
very.
listen, if I could invest in Axel's deals as well, I would invest with Axel for sure too. I just, get my own setup right there. But I'm pretty sure I would imagine putting two and two together that you probably worked with him before. Is that correct?
He's wallet guy. So,
Yeah.
I found his wallet on the street.
I actually did not realize that was a story there, but yeah, he's a stud.
That's yeah, no, Axel's great. Shout out to him. Yeah, so obviously I've done a number of deals with him in New Hampshire, which is in the Northeast, but it's not like New York, it's not like Connecticut. I own a few small multifamily in New York, and everything people say is true. It's a very tough place to own multifamily real estate. And I, at this point in my career, I would not raise money to buy multifamily in New York. But with that said, New York's a place where supply is very constrained. And because of that, there are still people that want to live in New York. There's only so many apartment units, and it drives up property values and it drives up rents. There's a lot of reasons not to invest in New York. I'm not saying that, but I look for areas like that where there's not a lot of units coming online, and I think with that it could even be, hey, there's a lot of Class A coming online in our market, but there's not a lot of Class B, and there's a huge gap between that, and we just don't expect the two to bleed over into each other. So yeah, focusing on things like that right now.
For sure. What do you think will struggle the most coming up?
I mean, office is the token answer, so I'm not going to say that.
Thank you, by the way. Something a little more captivating would be useful.
Totally, yeah. Real estate's hyper local. It's a business where people are making money everywhere and they're losing money everywhere, in all different asset classes and all different markets. So What's going to struggle is the hobbyist investor that's been riding the market for the last so many years. That is, now in a in an environment where you can't just buy real estate and expect it to go up. You have to buy it with a business plan where you're going to add value, where you have some other play that's going to generate the returns that you're looking for. So, I think that person's going to struggle. The person that is not really focused on buying real estate, but they're still out there making offers and trying to close on properties.
Right. What's making you most nervous about the recession coming up?
I'm going to go with the token answer here, but it's all the debt that's expiring in 2024. I think it's just this massive tidal wave that everybody keeps talking about. And I know there's a lot of capital on the sidelines that's going to be put into play and smooth things out. But it does make me nervous to hear all of the stories of people losing a lot of money right now. Limited partners and operators that are going through that. It's a really tough part of capitalism that all that's happening. And I think it's I don't see how you couldn't be nervous about all of that carnage happening in the background. So
Yeah,
that makes me pretty nervous.
it is wild to see legitimately dollars evaporating. And this is not, a couple dollars here and there. This is millions and billions of dollars that on paper gains, paper losses, nothing's realized until you buy or sell, right? But it is crazy to see that that's happening in real time. To see the loans that were done in 2020, where the deals aren't even worth the loan amount now. There's, a lot of that going on, and someone's got to foot that bill, which is scary. On the other side of that, what's getting you most excited about the opportunity coming up with the market shifting? Because naturally, we all know if you listen to anything investment related, we all know that investing in the recession is when you make fortunes. So with that said, what is getting you the most excited?
Well, all of those properties that I mentioned, which are struggling, they're going to need somebody to fix their problem for them. And while it makes me extremely nervous, I'm also excited for that because, like you said, you make money in a recession. The reason you do is because there are going to be deals that are going to be foreclosed on, have to be sold at their loan amount. It's happening now. And there, on the other side of that, there's going to be someone that's getting a great deal because of that. So there's a fair amount of negativity in the real estate space right now. I think people are just coming to terms with the decisions that were made 3 years ago, which you alluded to. But I really believe that buying deals today is so much better than buying deals 3 years ago. And I think there's a lot of opportunity if you can ignore the noise and you can stick to your fundamentals.
I love that. Final question for you, and I'll have to explain this if you need to, but do you know what a hot take is? I'm sure you
Yeah,
do.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
What is your real estate hot take? Or your hottest real estate take, I should say.
Yeah, I might have had a few in this interview so far, but
No, I
I'll
mean,
add a
listen, saying you're investing in the Northeast like that is certainly, I would say, bulletin board material for something that is a little bit contrarian and something to you, but I think you said it so well. It's all about just finding the basis, and it's a math equation to a certain extent, right? And if the math looks positive in Timbuktu, or if it looks positive in New York City or Dallas, then it makes sense, right? But I'll throw it back to you. What is the hottest take?
I'll add too that this probably isn't a hotter take than investing in New York. I think that's probably the hottest take I have, but another one is that most real estate investors are better off passively investing with some other experienced operator.
I think that's pretty great, actually. Can you go into a little more depth as to why you feel that way and why you know it to be true?
Mostly in conversations with people that are hobbyist investors, small-time investors, my own experiences being a small-time landlord, and then also my experiences working with operators that are at the top of their game and seeing the difference in deal flow, in how properties are managed, in how much risk we're taking on, and how much exposure we have. I think a lot of people just aren't aware that it's an option to go and invest alongside an operator who can align their interests with yours.
I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. TJ, where can people find you?
Find me on LinkedIn. So connect with me on LinkedIn at TJ Burns. And from there, you'll see links to go to my website, to get on my email list, to potentially invest with me if you're interested.
Cool. Any final thoughts you have for the show?
No, thanks for having me. This was awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on, TJ. TJ Burns of Burns Capital Partners, founder and principal there. Thank you for coming on, and we'll see you next week.